America behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Everyone, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ben Boland.
How very formal of you, Ben.
Yes, well, you know, we're talking about a subject that I have, I admittedly have some personal feelings about.
You've mentioned this a few times now. What's your goal here, I guess, in the near future, hopefully, right?
Oh gosh,
in the near future, I'm putting even more pressure on you.
You're making me blush.
You've mentioned this on the podcast and in private also, but on the podcast probably three or four times.
Have I?
Yeah, I think so.
Am I that transparent?
No, it's good. It's a good goal.
Well, let me get it out of my system so that nobody has to listen to it again. Let me first thank you for putting up with me doing this. But way back in the days of yore, when I was but a wee young tyke, my dad, who is a fan of classic cars, he and I had a conversation. Now this is years and years ago, Scott. And, I asked him, being even at that age, unreasonably ambitious, I asked him, what sort of car he would like. I would buy him a car. Because he wanted to get a car at the time, but we didn't really have the money, you know. And he said that if wishes were horses, he would have a Packard. And I told him that if I ever got fantastically wealthy or something, that I would do my best to get him a Packard. And to his great amusement and probably the same amount of skepticism he had when I was, you know, six or seven, I still remember this. And
does he know you that you remember this? Have you mentioned this to him recently?
Oh yeah, he knows.
Okay, so I thought maybe this is something that you were just carrying with you here, and you're someday going to surprise him with it. But he knows that you're planning to do this, maybe.
If I can ever make that happen, I would love to make it happen. All bias aside, he's a great guy, and I know he would take care of it. And objectively, and I'm going to say this is not a matter of taste on my part, objectively, the Packard Motor Company has made some of the most well-engineered, or I guess most sturdy vehicles in U.S. automotive history.
Sure, just ask the man who owns one.
Ask the man who owns one. Yes, Scott, indeed, for our listeners who haven't made that association. First off, for our listeners who already knew what this was about, based on the slogan, you are our people.
Sure.
You guys are awesome.
Congrats. To the rest of you, that's still fine. I mean, maybe not everybody's heard this or has been around the advertising world for automobiles in their past.
Right.
But that was a very famous slogan or ad campaign that lasted, I would think, the length of the, decades, really.
Yeah, length of the company.
This goes back to like 1901, and not even the beginning of the Packard Motor Company. We'll talk about the history in a moment, but that phrase was first used by the Packard Motor Company in I think it was on Halloween in 1901. When the phrase came out. It was something like we provide the most reliable and sturdy made vehicles, and if you don't believe us, just ask the man who owns one. And that stuck. It somehow stuck with them, and it became very, very popular, and it was just kind of a not really pop culture thing, but it's just everybody knew about it. It was a household slogan, really.
Yeah.
And for a long, long time.
I think it was a household slogan. It's sort of like you might hear the running joke with the iPod or the iPod, iPad, iPhone campaigns about apps, where there's this running slogan and household phrase people are using, like, oh, there's an app for that.
Yeah, or remember Chevy's Like a Rock campaign.
Perfect.
That a lot of people for a long time, you couldn't say the words Like a Rock without somebody saying, oh, like a Chevrolet truck. It was a lot of things like that that kind of permeate your life in different ways. And this is one of those things that, people just said this and they knew what they meant. They knew they're talking about the Packard Motor Company.
And here's the crazy thing. This slogan, wasn't just effective advertising because it sounded good. This slogan worked because the automobile company in question backed up the hype.
Yes, they did. This is one of those really, I'm going to say this is This is a pretty interesting story. I don't want to say it's the greatest story or anything like
that.
That's
not fair.
But it's a pretty interesting story about how the entire company really came around because this is a long history. This company started in 1899, Ben.
Yes.
1899.
When, James Ward Packard, who was a mechanical engineer, picked up an automobile made by Winton.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Winton. Yeah.
Yeah. And, so, you guys know how engineers are. I'm sure quite a few of our listeners are engineers. The Winton automobile, the one that James got.
In 1898, by the way.
So yes, this is the year before.
This is the dawn of the automobile. Mm-hmm. The very, very dawn of it, yeah.
Well, James wasn't too happy with his Winton, because the first long trip he took it on, the Winton broke down.
Oh my gosh.
And so he wants to give the vehicle back. And then
he did give the vehicle back. And not only that, but he took it back to the founder of the company.
He
took it back
himself.
To Winton himself, Alexander Winton, and had a fight. I don't think it was a fist fight. But maybe.
I mean,
it sounds like it got really heated.
Details, it's true. Details are a little bit vague, but we do know it was pretty heated because it concluded with Winton saying, you know what? You think you can build a better one? Go ahead.
Go ahead and do it. So so this is kind of funny because Mr. James Ward Packard, said, you know what? I'm going to do that. Challenge accepted.
Yes.
So here he is in 1898. Accepts this challenge that he's going to build a better car, right? Okay, mm-hmm. So better than Winton's built. Now he is a mechanical engineer,
right?
But he kind of enlists the help of his brother, William Dowd Packard, who they're in Warren, Ohio, by the way. Warren, Ohio is in northeastern Ohio. It's kind of near the Pennsylvania border.
Yeah.
1 year later, they had a car ready to go. Can you believe that?
Now, their first car is a one-cylinder, and it's made by their original name, the Ohio Automobile Company.
Sure. Right? Ben, you skipped over it.
This is 1 year.
This is 1 year later. They have a car ready to go. Can you believe that?
He must have been really steamed.
Can you imagine how angry he must have been in that garage building that one car?
I bet he had like a photograph of Winton or whatever up there,
and that he punched every time he walked by it. Yeah, I bet. I mean, it sounds like it was that kind of thing because this it was really a challenge. He threw down the gauntlet. He said, build a better one, and he said, well, I'm going to try.
And as everybody knows, there's a lot of interest in even today, it's very difficult to build a car from scratch, so much so that other countries that don't have a car industry usually end up just buying imports instead of trying to foster their own industry. Mm-hmm. That's how difficult it is to build all of the things that you need to build to make a successful car. So in the space of a year, which to me means they had no vacation, they were probably not sleeping that much, these guys managed to build a working car.
Sure. The first Packard, really.
The first
Packard, which was, like you said, a single cylinder car. It was a buggy type car, of course, because it came from, what was a horse carriage, really.
Yeah.
As all cars did
at that
time. Which
is the convention of the day.
Exactly. Exactly. So, again, this is 1899, and they've got this car for sale, and early on, they wanted to test them for reliability because that was the goal here, right? They wanted to make a reliable, durable vehicle that it was, all-around performing car, I guess, right?
And in the beginning, at the very least, it had to be better than a Winton.
Yeah, that was right.
And I'm not saying anything bad about Winton.
No.
This is what Packard was going for.
I'm kind of thinking that – I think I heard that Winton was one of the first cars to cross the United States, really. I believe it was. It was in one of the I'll have to look that up. That's another story. I think we've talked about that. By 1904, they had a car called the Gray Wolf. And if you've ever heard of the Gray Wolf, this is kind of an interesting story too. There's little developments here and there. Of course, they're building and building. We'll talk about a timeline here in a minute.
Sure.
As some of the firsts, because there were some major firsts in Packard history.
Yeah.
Automobile firsts.
And by 1904, they have, moved. They've changed their name and they moved to Detroit.
Oh, very good. Okay. They had the Packard Motor Company in Detroit. You had to be in Detroit at that time.
You absolutely did.
I mean, I think
that's
you could
all the subsidiary industries are.
Yeah. Yeah. You had to be there in order to be a name in automobile industry at the time. So they've got, by 1904, they got this car that they call the Grey Wolf. And the Grey Wolf is a racing car. It's a speedster type. So it's an open top. It has an aluminum body and a total weight of just 1300 pounds, Ben. The incredible thing about this is they entered it in the 1904 Vanderbilt Cup race, right?
Yeah.
And they took fourth place, which is remarkable. I mean, here's a company that 5 years before that didn't exist. Well, 6 years before it didn't exist. And so now they're taking fourth place in the Vanderbilt Cup. And the crazy thing, this is maybe the craziest part about this, they offered it to the public as a production model. You could buy a Grey Wolf that was a racing car in 1904.
Which means that when you buy it, you don't have to buy additional modifications. You don't have to take it to some specialty folks who would make it race-worthy. Mm-hmm. You could drive off the lot with this thing that got fourth place.
I guess, you know what's funny? You think about NASCAR. NASCAR is supposed to be kind of like this, right? I mean, that's the idea behind it originally.
Sure. That's the
theory. That the cars that race are the cars that you could buy. You know, it's race on Sunday, sell on Monday. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea behind it originally. And I think it still is the idea, of course. But this was true to that form. I mean, this is – you could look at that car on the track and buy the exact same car in the showroom and drive it home.
And this wasn't just the idea. This was the practice,
I think,
is what we're saying.
Yeah.
Now, tell me if I'm jumping ahead when I go to 1919.
No, go ahead.
All right. So 1919 – now, they've won fourth place previously. In 1919 – a Packard captures the land speed record.
Yeah.
Of the time.
Who would have guessed?
Not Winton.
No, and not me. I mean, look back at not Winton. That's right.
I would never.
Looking back at a 1919 Packard, that doesn't look like a particularly aerodynamic, speed-worthy vehicle. But it had a little secret under the hood, didn't it?
Yeah, it had a 12-cylinder engine.
Okay, so we're going from a 1-cylinder buggy type car to a 12-cylinder car that is breaking world speed records.
And that speed record, just for comparison with today's land speed records, that was on Daytona Beach, and it hit a speed of just under 150.
So it's on sand.
It's on sand.
On sand. That's impressive in itself, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was here it is. Ralph DePalma, who was an Indianapolis driver.
Right.
At the time. That's early in Indianapolis history, by the way. Daytona Beach, 149 miles per hour in the measured mile.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, it was held by the Stanley Steamer, I think is what they said, right?
Yeah.
So that's
I read that too.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right, so I guess after this, though, the weird thing is that, like, it wasn't the car is not really all about speed. That's the thing. It's about prestige. It's more about luxury. It's more about reliability. And it's just a solid, solid car.
Yeah.
And that's what they kind of focused on from that point forward. I guess in the 1930s, that was what they were known for. It was dependable. Mm-hmm. It was reliable. It was solid. It was not really a speed car, although it was fast because they had these big 8-cylinder engines that they were using.
Right.
And then later these 12-cylinder engines that they were using. And maybe even at the time they were using 12s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, the idea behind it was, and I quote here, solid elegance.
Right. Which is a great way to look at it, because if you look at it's worth your time too, guys, to check out some video or images of these vehicles, because if you look at them, that solid elegance phrase applies perfectly, because Packard is, let's see, here's a good example. We've had some, episodes about, higher end car companies whose customers want the vehicles to stay higher end. They say don't come out with a cheaper vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Aston Martin, Bentley, perfect. And
Porsche,
Rolls Royce.
Yeah, they're basically saying keep our club exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And until about the 40s, that's what Packard was.
Yeah, that's right. They were in a kind of that upper tier of automobile manufacturing, and you know, right along with Rolls Royce, and right along with the Bentleys and you know, the top end of vehicles of the day. And the crazy thing is that, you know, at the same time, Cadillac is on its way up, right?
Right. And Cadillac's the up and coming.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny to think about it that way, because now, you know, you still associate the name Cadillac with style and grace, but until this point in the 30s, I don't know if it was really on the level of Packard. I'm just not sure. I don't know how it was all playing out at the time. You know, who was more at the top, but I believe that Packard was even on top of that, on top at that time.
Yes.
Now here's what happened is that in the 30s, this kind of competition between GM and Packard started to grow. And if you recall, I mean, a lot of people know about this, but in the 1930s, Cadillac came out with these enormous V16 engines.
Right.
And
yeah.
So, you know, here's the Packard with, okay, eights are pretty typical, right?
Mm-hmm.
V8s at the time are pretty typical.
Sure.
Packard has a V12. There are other companies that have V12s too, but right. Packard has a V12, which is really strong.
The Twin Six.
Exactly. Yeah. And the Cadillac brand comes out with a V16. Okay. Now that, what's weird about this is that the public, I guess, just said, well, here's a V16. That's got to be better than a V12.
Right.
So I'm going to give that a shot, you know, look at it. And they kind of followed that instead of going with the trusted known, you know, that Packard's already producing this 12 that's a solid engine.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a look at the V16 in the Cadillac and see if maybe I want that. And Cadillac started to gain this foothold as being the top or the peak in American luxury vehicles at the time.
Right.
I don't know if I stated that very clearly.
Yeah, that makes sense, because let's also keep in mind that at the time, a luxury vehicle typically was thought of as being European. So American-made luxury vehicle is at this time sort of its own niche.
Mm-hmm.
And the leapfrogging that happens, now let's not be anything less than clear about this, you know, Packard's V12 leapfrogs the Cadillac engine, and then Cadillac leapfrogs Packard.
Exactly.
Which is completely the way things go in these sorts of industries, any kind of competitive business. Nobody is playing any sort of shady game here. This is just the nature of the beast, I guess. And then let's see if we can go up to...
Well, let's get to the war years because...
Yeah, that's where I'm going, yeah.
Just before... here's the thing. But just before the war, Packard released a model that was a lot smaller because the sales were starting to decline because of the Cadillac sales were going up.
Right,
okay,
right.
So they're taking away their market a bit. People are shifting over to Cadillac. And
let's keep in mind this is a depression and World War I have happened as well.
Exactly. And now, you know, these are high-end vehicles we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So not everybody can afford one, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So what Packard does is something that a lot of companies are doing these days. They downsized it a bit. They downsized the size of the car. Not necessarily the company. I don't know about that. But
right.
They downsized the size of the vehicle. And they brought out a vehicle called the 120.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the 120 is the car that actually saved the company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a smaller car. It's modestly priced.
It's the first one under $1,000.
It really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I believe so.
Oh, okay. Okay. Very good. They were able to save the company by doing this because then, not everybody, but, you know, somebody with moderate income and, you know, mm-hmm. the more of a middle class person could afford a Packard at this point.
And they could say, now, of course, remember a lot of this is prestige. So they could say, yes, as a matter of fact, I do have a Packard.
That's exactly right.
You know, I have a Packard 120.
Is that your country club voice?
This is sort of my country club.
Very nice.
I mean, the eyebrows really make it more.
Yeah, it's true.
So
and you're wearing that captain's cap and, you know, the ascot and the jacket.
Did you see my boat?
Yeah,
it's in the parking lot.
Very nice, very nice. So anyways, the war happens, right?
Yeah, the war happens. And in 1942, the United States government orders all the automobile manufacturers to stop making cars and to start shifting their manufacturing efforts to support the war. So that means instead of building 120s, instead of building Cadillacs, we've got these auto manufacturers building components for aircraft, building components for boats. And then if they are building vehicles, they're building military vehicles. They're building emergency rescue vehicles, right?
Can I break in here?
Break in.
Okay, because I've got a little bit of info about this. And this is a bit of a sidebar here, okay?
Yeah.
We'll get back to it, I promise.
Sidebars are like the best parts
okay,
of this
now,
podcast.
Okay, now, You know what proving grounds are, right?
Yes.
We've got an article on our site about how proving grounds work and, you know, what. Well, the first proving ground was actually a General Motors facility. And trust me, I'm getting around to the Packard stuff.
I got you, man.
The first proving grounds were built in 1924, okay? And it was built by GM in Milford, Michigan. First ever anywhere, okay? Mm-hmm. It's where they test vehicles. They put them through their paces and see how they hold up, right? Huge facilities, just enormous. And they're not on the property of the headquarters or anything like that. They're often set way far away. Away from
right.
everybody so they can do their testing.
And there's a lot of high security and secrecy.
Yeah. Okay. So 1925, Ford came up with they said, well, that's a great idea, GM. I'm going to do this as well. So they built one in Dearborn, Michigan, and that one's still around as well. So it's the Milford Proving Grounds. 1925, at the same year that Ford built theirs, Packard built their first Proving Ground. And it was built in Shelby Township, Michigan. It's about 20 miles north of Detroit, the Detroit factory, the manufacturing facility. And some of the features that this place had, it had a speedway. Mm-hmm. It had what they called a Badlands, which was really just these looked like softball-sized rocks or maybe bigger.
Okay.
It was just a really, really rough road that they tested the cars on. Of course, it had hills and water and gravel pits and deep sand and,
sure.
you know, all the different testing facilities or tracks or types of road surface that you'd need. Well, they also had an aircraft hangar, on the property. Okay. And you can still see this property. They have a timing tower. They've got the original buildings, the carriage houses. You can see the Packard Drive, I think is what it is. You know, that, you know, there's an entrance.
Right.
It's really a grand entrance to this place, the big gates and everything. Part of the original track is there, but not much of it. Okay.
So the hangar.
The hangar is still there. They've had to move the hangar, but the hangar is where they used to experiment with Packard diesel engines for planes. And get this, Charles Lindbergh, who flew the Spirit of St. Louis,
yeah.
he flew Packard-powered airplanes with these diesel engines.
You know, my first reaction is to go, no way. And accuse you of trying to pull an April Fool's type of thing
no,
on me.
No, this is real.
Yeah, but this is real because the one of the biggest things that Packard produced during the war efforts, engines.
Mm-hmm.
They became pretty much an engine manufacturer.
It makes perfect sense because here they've got these solid, reliable engines that are very, very strong, and they're experimenting with these diesel engines.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of unknown at the time, you know. And Lindbergh, I guess, was one of these guys that said, "I'd try it out for you. Let's do it." And
oh,
so there are photos of him standing on the Packard Proving Grounds with, you know, the planes behind him, and some of the facility staff. Standing around as well, you know, for the photo op, I guess. But kind of a, you know, it's funny if you read some of the stories about when he was on site, a bit of a cold reception on his part. Not them towards him towards the staff. He never, one of the guys that mentioned it there, it was in his notes that the guy never said a word to him. And he was the one who was out there, you know, this engineer, whoever it was out there in charge of, like, warming up the cylinders of the plane and getting everything all ready to go. So when he arrived, you know, he could just step into it.
Apparently, that's all he did was step in.
It was almost like he never even looked at the guy, never motioned towards him, never said anything to him, very coldly stepped into the plane, didn't ask about how to control it, because the guy knew how to fly it.
Right.
He said he just stepped in, flew the plane, landed the plane, stepped out, and left. And that was pretty much it. So, interesting little reading that you can do there. And that, you know, that information comes from the Packard Motor Car Foundation, which is a site that you can find online. And they've got all this stuff. And I think you can find those notes about when Lindbergh visited, but okay.
Well, that was a great sidebar.
Wow. That's past the war stuff, but that's,
we're past the war.
I thought
stuff.
That was really interesting.
And the thing is, that's more and more when you look at the history of this company for the people who are unfamiliar with it, either because you don't really follow car history or you're just young and you don't know about it, there are tons of stories about the Packard company that have almost legendary status. Like, to be honest with you, I knew a little bit about the Charles Lindbergh thing, but I didn't know the extent of which it happened. I didn't know we could actually find notes about his apparently winning personality.
Oh, no, you know, you can find, you know, I'm not going to say that was the case every time. Maybe he's having a bad day.
Who knows?
But anyways, maybe not. We'll
so,
see.
Okay. So,
yeah, anyways, so you can find photos of him with the Packard powered planes.
And these planes, these engines, they do well for the war effort. After 1945, of course, the Allies win World War II, and Packard, along with other auto manufacturers, gets back to their core business, building vehicles. Now, the weird thing is, they're in good financial condition, but because of the way they had to store their equipment for manufacturing automobiles, I'm going to go ahead and call it, they're kind of up the creek without a paddle.
Mm-hmm.
Because this stuff, they couldn't really store it in the proper storage facility. Now, when we say equipment, we mean the manufacturing equipment that they use to make vehicles.
Yeah, the assembly line, basically.
Right. The assembly line, basically, is out there during World War II with, like, a tarp over it.
Yeah, yeah. That's sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because and it can't be neglected like that. That stuff requires, you know, maintenance constantly.
Right.
Even the modern machines require a lot of maintenance, and it just can't sit and I guess it can't rot away like that, really.
Right. So they can't they have to, a lot of this equipment, a lot of these supplies are beyond the point of repair. They have to be replaced.
And not only that, Ben, this is like strike number two, really.
Yeah.
The public wanted smaller cars. They
wanted
smaller cars because, you know, this is when the GIs came back and they had, you know, they had seen some of these European vehicles they really liked, and they're even bringing vehicles back like the Austin Healey, and they're bringing back small sports cars, the British sports cars. They've really fallen in love with these things, and that's what they want. They want something that, you know, can get good mileage and, you know, that's fun and sporty, and it's not the giant vehicles, you know, that we had in the past with these big carriages.
Right. Solid elegance is beginning to decline in the public eye.
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's just not enough to – you can't base an entire company on it, and you'd have to have a diversified line. And Packard at the time, other than the 120 that they came out with right before the war, they didn't really have that. And, and like you said, they were kind of up a creek without being able to produce a car immediately without a lot of work on getting that line back together again.
Yeah, yeah. So for example, 1946, they make the when they finally start making these vehicles again, they say, okay, we're just going to make the Clippers. We're going to get rid of the other model lines, which, you know, is a necessity considering the overhead they've got for their equipment. And this is what I was telling you about off the air earlier. The Clippers that they made at this time in the 40s, they're the ones that had an alarm on the gas tank. So it would whistle as the fuel was pumped, and it would stop when the tank was full.
Wait, okay. So, you got to say that one more time,
okay,
because I'm confused about this. There's a whistle in the fuel tank?
Yeah. I'm just saying, because Scott and I were talking about interesting features in Packards before we went on the air. So, okay, you're pumping up your Clipper, right? You're putting the gas in, and as you're pumping it, you hear this whistle, you know, and then because this is before, like, automatic shutoff and stuff. So you hear this whistle, and then it just stops when the tank is full.
Interesting.
Which is a neat little innovation, it's something that you don't see in cars today.
You know what? I've got a tiny bit of reference for this. My daughter has a bath toy when she was a kid. That it was like a floating dolphin thing that you would tap on its head, and it was a whistle. And the water level in the bathtub would make it whistle by blowing air through it when you hit it.
Oh, that's cool.
You push it through the water. So that must have been the same exact principle.
Like the same concept.
Yeah, is pushing air through the whistle. Mm-hmm. And then once it got past that point, it couldn't whistle anymore. You knew to stop, right?
And so we're like detectives over here.
Yeah,
sure. So the Clipper, though,
it's
you
like
know.
60-year-old technology.
I didn't say we're the best detectives.
Yeah, okay.
But the Clipper here, it's wider than it's like a foot wider than it is tall, so it's like the widest production vehicle in production at the time. And you know, as you said, the American public at this point, they want the smaller ones. We want we don't want the yachts anymore. We want the darts. We want the fast ones.
So basically Packard's in trouble at this point, really.
Packard's in deep trouble.
Packard's in trouble. So, what happened was, and we'll just kind of get to the point here, because it does go away. Packard goes away in 1958, but just before that, it had merged with the Studebaker Corporation.
Yes.
And for a short time, they tried to keep it together.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to keep producing Packards. They tried to keep producing Studebakers.
Mm-hmm.
They eventually had to drop the Packard line. They said, you know, it just isn't working out anymore. Studebaker was also in trouble.
Right.
As were a lot of companies at the time. It was just real tight economic times. And that's about it. I mean, finally, you know, Packard was gone in 1958. I think the last one, I have a number here, the last Studebaker came off of an assembly line in South Bend, Indiana, mm-hmm. on July 13th, 1958. That was the very last Packard.
Which is a sad ending for a company, but I do have one funny thing about it. One of the reasons, and this is weird, but one of the reasons that some historians think the Packard car company was in trouble in the post-war decline, decline in demand for luxury cars, mm-hmm. is that they kind of made their cars too well. There wasn't any planned obsolescence?
I know what you mean.
Obsolescence.
You're saying that they didn't build certain parts to break?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
So there weren't enough people coming back to have to buy new cars.
This is the conspiracy theorist in you.
I'm quoting. And I think that's a very sympathetic look at it.
Yeah.
I don't think that explains all of it.
No. So, I've got a couple of things here. If you want to wrap it up, I've got just a few little kind of interesting little facts, I think, that maybe people would be interested in hearing. You want to hear some of them?
Yes, sir.
All right. So, before we get too far into this, I do want to mention that there's a National Packard Museum
mm-hmm.
That people can go to. It's in Warren, Ohio, which is the birthplace of Packard.
Good call, Scott.
And that is, again, that's in northeastern Ohio. It's right near the Pennsylvania border, kind of near Youngstown, Ohio. That's, I guess, point of reference.
Right.
So if you want to go there. There's also a let's see. What did I say here? Hang on. There's a Packard Motor Car Foundation that was founded in 1997 that people can take a look for online, look at online. Two or three other things, really.
Hmm.
Someone has revived the Packard name. Do you know that?
I have heard rumors.
Yeah. If you go online and you look at, www.packardmotorcar.com. PackardMotorCar.com. Mm-hmm. A couple by the name of Roy and Barbara Gullickson purchased the rights to the Packard name in 1995, and they're out of Scottsdale, Arizona, mm-hmm. Right here in the United States. And they actually produced a concept vehicle that that bears the Packard name because they've got the rights to the Packard name.
Yeah.
The car was shown at the Pebble Beach Concours in 2003.
No way.
I've got a photo of it here if you want to look at it.
Yeah.
And anybody at home can follow along, but that is the vehicle right there. And it's kind of this – I'm going to say it's an odd mix of new and old. It's a luxury-looking car, but it has some newer features to it. And if you open the hood – there's a really interesting looking engine that has, the old Packard emblem and, mm-hmm. Kind of like, almost like the metal has that quilted look to it that covers it. There's a metal cover to the engine. Really sharp.
It's still a V12.
There's some things that I like. Oh yeah, it's a great big, I should say that. Yeah, it's a great big Packard V12 engine.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's a huge Packard V12 engine.
You can tell looking from the hood.
The specs here. It's a V12 all aluminum overhead valve fuel injected engine with racing heritage. It's a 525 cubic inch engine. So this is a big engine, okay?
Man.
573 horsepower and 593 foot-pounds of torque is what this thing registered on the dyno. So that's big. It looks like it's enormous. I mean, there's a picture of a guy leaning against it, but in actuality, I mean, it's big. Don't get me wrong, but it's about 17 and a half feet long. That's the length of this thing. It looks longer than that. And it's about 6 feet wide. So the proportions, I don't know. It's strange, but,
I still have to buy my dad one of the old ones.
Yeah, definitely. This is more of the, modern look of the thing. It's got some of the old elements, like the grille's kind of similar. Mm-hmm. The wheels are really unique. Flat chrome, very strange. But, I don't know. I'm on the fence if I like that one or not.
Yeah.
Here's another one that I found.
What?
I found another one that's, this one's maybe more up our, reader's alley here, listener's alley, because this one is called the 1946 Aero Packard Flyer. It's called the Dream Rod.
Oh, goodness gracious. That's a hot rod.
It's a 2,000 horsepower hot rod with get this, 41 liter engine.
What?
A 41 liter motor. 2,000 horsepower. That's 3,000 pound feet of torque. This car is 31 feet long, Ben. Take a look at that one.
Wow.
But, look up Dream Rod.
Yeah.
You're going to see this enormous Packard. It's a silver vehicle that you'll see at a car show. Incredible. Mm. You can even find video of that thing starting up. And when it starts up, it just blows the camera away. The audio just is a rumble. It sounds like thunder.
Made incidentally by Rodney Rucker. So shout out to him.
Very, very impressive.
My mother would kill me if I ever got something like that.
The car
is
31 feet long.
31 feet
long.
Yeah,
and 3,000 pound-feet of torque. That's huge. That's kind of like competing with, what's Jay Leno's car? The tank?
Yeah, the tank car. Yeah,
the tank car. Okay. Brother, I'm on a roll here. I got two more things before we go. You want to take a look at some of those and maybe mention them, and then the last note on there when you
okay.
Got it.
Some of the first here.
Yeah, some of the first.
Okay, so we've mentioned the H pattern gear shift arrangement.
Yeah, okay. That's right. First and yeah. 1901.
Yeah, there are some other things there. Also, 1901, the use of a steering wheel instead of a tiller.
Can you believe that?
That was Packard.
Packard is the first to use a steering wheel, because before that, remember Henry Ford's vehicle, that quadricycle that had it had the rudder control.
Yeah, it's like you would find on a boat engine or something.
What do they call it? A tiller, I think is what
they call
it.
Yeah, it's a tiller.
Yeah, tiller.
And then this is a year before, 1900, automatic ignition spark advance. Mm-hmm. And they also have spiral bevel differential gears, 1913.
That's an important one, because that, you know, when you hear gears mashing together?
Yeah.
That spiral bevel, that's what prevents that sound from happening. So this really quieted down shifting cars, because before that it was a grind and then it's gone. You know, you're in gear. This point, it made it perfectly smooth, and that's how gears are cut today, so that you don't hear every single gear. I mean, of course there's synchro meshes and everything else, but this went a long way in making cars a lot quieter to drive.
And also that's one of the things that sets forth this concept we have of luxury cars as being very quiet.
Actually, you know what? Even in just driving conditions, if they're flat gears, they're going to make a lot of noise. You're going to hear a clacking sound as they come together, and that design prevented that.
Mass-produced V12 engines or V12 powered autos in 1915. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that speaks for itself.
1915, they're making a 12-cylinder engine.
Not 1915. Wow. First neon signs in America in 1923.
That's a big one. Yeah. The very first neon sign. So, you know, you think Vegas is maybe the first place you'd see that happening, right?
Right, but it's L.A.
Packard dealership. Yeah. Packard dealership. And can you imagine what people thought when they saw a neon sign?
Well, I know they stopped to look at it.
It was huge. Yeah. They're huge signs.
And then also 1940, first company to offer AC, air conditioning in vehicles, for $275.
What year was that?
For 1940.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then we've got some automatic leveling. We also have other improvements.
Automatic leveling in 1955. Can you believe that? Right. That's pretty incredible. I mean, it was with this torsion bar suspension system that they had, which is kind of cool. So, okay, there's one more. This is the very last thing I promise, because we've talked a long time about Packard, but this is I found this interesting and a bit sad, Ben.
What is it?
And it's not really that sad. It's just, it's interesting.
Okay, well, I'm going to put the violin away.
And this is again from the same place. This is from one of the
foundation.
I think so. Yeah. Get this. In 1947, Henry Ford died. Right.
Yes.
Henry Ford was taken to the graveyard in a Packard hearse, not in a Lincoln.
I don't think he would have been happy with
that. I don't think so either. I think that's the kind of storyline we're going at here, is that, you know, I don't think that he would have been happy about this. And because this is why. This is a weird little tale here. It kind of roundabout way, but, Lincoln did offer a commercial chassis, which, you know, that we've talked about,
how hearses
service vehicles.
Yeah.
We had how hearses are made. They did not offer a commercial chassis post-war. The last time that they offered one was in 1937. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they were making hearses in 1937 and prior, but they weren't making many of them even at that point. Okay. So, you know, there's a quote here that says that there are actually minuscule production numbers prior to that point. So finding a Lincoln made hearse, or Lincoln hearse, really.
Yeah.
That was about 10 years old at that point, because, you know, this is 1947 when he died.
Nearly impossible.
It would have been impossible to find, because you're talking about a matter of days before he was actually, you know, between when he died and when he was taken to the graveyard. Of course, you know, there's a big public funeral and everything, but you don't know what's going to happen until it does, right?
Oh,
this
my
is unexpected.
Gosh.
And so they were able to find a Packard hearse, and they used it. And it was a great big luxury car, you know, beautiful hearse. I've seen photos of it.
Yeah.
But they mention several times that, you know, Henry, he wasn't, when he was alive, he was very uncomfortable in anything other than a car with his name on it. He didn't like the anything other than he didn't like to be in a car other than a Ford.
If he returns from the dead, man, nobody tell him.
So I mean, there's
that
no,
guy is brilliant and crazy.
I mean, there's no doubt that he would have hated this last ride that he took in this Packard hearse. But I just thought it was kind of an interesting footnote on this whole thing is that here's a Packard automobile taking the founder of the Ford Motor Company to his gravesite. Strange.
It's strange, and it's a very neat point for us to end on for this podcast, because what we've done here, we hope you guys have enjoyed the show today. What we've done here, what we've attempted to do, is give you a snapshot of one of the great companies of American automotive industries and what happened to it. Now, we hope that you have some Packard stories for us. Of course, you know, I'm always in the market for a cut-rate deal on a Packard.
Sure, if you got one for sale, pass it along. We'll take a look at it.
Oh, yeah, and wait a couple decades so I can get up to that level.
Reasonably priced.
But seriously, guys, if you want to learn more about this, hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, check out our website. And if you have a story about Packards, if you would like to hear more about the history of a specific car company or vehicle, or if you have a topic you want to hit us with out of the blue, send us an email at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.